Blog Talk Radio.
From the deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, the SRI Label Group, Wildlife Educational Services, and Blog Talk Radio present Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover with us the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we discover his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Patterson, having a wonderful day here in Indiana as we enjoy temperatures of about 75 degrees, a little bit of rain this morning. It's absolutely fantastic here in Clinton Falls, Indiana. And of course, as always, from the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, now HD, and the beautiful Knotty Pine paneling really sets it off. The honorable, distinguished, and always on same time. Dr. Henry Day, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Batson. You're cutting out there a little bit. Might check your wiring.
Huh, I wonder why that is. Well, we'll see if I can, we'll try and get our technical expertise on it right away.
That sounds a little better.
Okay, I think I know the problem. My loud mouth.
Overriding the airwaves.
Yes, that's right. Hey, we're excited today because our good friend Bob Jackson, Yellowstone Park Ranger, is going to be along with us today. And he's always a fantastic show. I have to tell you, I was in Ohio, Hocking Hills State Park, Ohio, last weekend for the Hocking Hills Bigfoot Conference, and everyone came up to me talking about our show. That's been, gosh, 2 years ago with Bob Jackson. So I'm really excited he's on with us today.
Me too.
So are you ready to kick off the Wild World News, Dr. Day?
Let's get on with it. I'm excited Bob's on. I want to talk to Bob.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good afternoon. It's Sunday, October the 7th. This month is moving along already. We're almost into Halloween. Well, yeah. All right, we've got a big baby on the way in Buffalo, New York. Yes, the Buffalo Zoo's Tashi, a greater one-horned rhinoceros, is expected to give birth in the summer of 2019. So start thinking of baby names. We're going to need to name the new baby rhinoceros. Now, I've got a good name for a rhino. What do you think about horny?
I don't know. We have Bob Jackson on the line. He might have an idea about that.
I think you guys will take care of that as to a horn rhinoceros. And yeah, all I think of is the good years that you always grew up with, thinking of the African safari and the animals there. Yeah, so just having one is pretty neat to have, whatever they are.
Well, I think they should name it. How about that? So there we go.
All right, we're off to Reno, Nevada. Now, firefighters had to help three bear cubs escape from a dumpster. Now, who would throw away baby bear cubs?
I don't know who.
Well, I don't know either. But anyway, they rescued the little guys. We're glad they're safe. And I'm sure their mom was not too far off watching the whole operation. All right, now, our next story, we don't generally like to mention names that are involved in these stories, but Lawrence Payne of Olathe, Kansas, will face up to a year in jail and a $50,000 fine for importing endangered Asian leopards. Now, why are they in danger? Well, they're because of idiots like you importing them into the country. Lawrence Payne of Olathe, Kansas.
Well, we all know that the main problem with endangered animals and the decline of their populations is habitat. You know, their habitat being destroyed. So you know, if they have enough room, enough places to hide and hunt, they'll be okay. But, destruction of habitat, palm oils, what they're doing to the forest in Southeast Asia, the poor, just horrible. So,
agreed.
A weak place, they'll live.
I think the fine should be like 10 years in jail and $100,000.
How about a public neutering?
Well, we'll talk about that. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. All right, they're giving them the bird in Kansas City, Missouri. About 100 North American game birds were sent from Wisconsin to Missouri as part of an effort to restore Missouri's ruffed grouse population.
I don't know. Did they have ruffed grouse in Iowa, Bob?
Yeah, in fact, I was just wondering when they had ruffed grouse, even, you know, you think of them mostly in northern, like Wisconsin, Minnesota, up and through there. Northern Iowa had ruffed grouse, but I really didn't know that they went all the way into Missouri. Did they go further than that, even south, ruffed grouse?
Not that I know of. We do have grouse here. They're not the ruffed grouse, but, yeah, I don't know for sure.
Hmm. I mean, I've seen them. I've hunted them, but nothing. It's neat to know that they were. I mean, antelope used to be in western Iowa. And, of course, we had bears, grizzly bears, that they found evidence clear out to Ohio. So some of these areas, you know, when things were colder, you know, wolverine were in Iowa, which I imagine they were even went down into Missouri, some of that. But loons, loons, I don't know how far loons go south, but they used to go further south, too. So we have in our place right here in southern Iowa, we got some holdovers from an earlier ice age. We got the only hardwood maple in Iowa, except for up in northern Iowa, northeast Iowa. We got flying squirrels. I don't know where their range was originally, but some of these animals we have are kind of neat, and I always like to think of what places like the Midwest used to have. So, yeah, I think it's great. If they had ruffed grouse there, which I'm sure they did, if they were down in Missouri, yeah, it's great if they can get those back in. I think it's great.
Yeah, that's good.
All right.
Boy,
on to old.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was saying, what a great guest Bob Jackson is already. Gosh, all this insight.
And the show's just started, All right,
I
on
know.
To Old Orchard Beach, Maine. Now, a scientist studying whether white sharks are becoming more common in Maine waters says another one has been detected. Well, that tells me the study should be over. The answer is yes, they are becoming more common.
Cool. That's great.
Yep. Except for people who are terrified of sharks and shark attacks. And
except for people that may want to go swimming in the ocean, that may be a problem. It's about
at Fort Jefferson National Monument, we had a nurse shark that would be in the moat all the time. Nice big moat nurse shark. So that was a favorable response, seeing that thing there every day. So anyway, that's my comment on sharks. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Fantastic. All right, Henry.
All right, Santa Fe, New Mexico. The city is considering hiring a contractor to eradicate the gophers that have been tearing up their city parks for the last 2 years. Now, how would you handle that situation?
Oh, well, let's see. Well, anytime we try to add species to take care of a problem, it never works. So a natural predator would be ferrets, but... we don't want to do that.
Either that or we're going to have to set up some hawk towers.
Yeah.
What was a natural predator of pocket gopher? I mean, you hear about prairie dogs and, of course, what they had, you know, the black-footed ferret, but I wonder what the gopher is because they're mostly underground all the time.
Prairie dogs are coyotes a lot in that area of the country. Santa Fe, the coyotes.
You talking about pocket gophers, or are you talking about prairie dogs?
We're talking about basically prairie dogs.
Oh, okay. I thought you said gophers they were trying to get.
That's what they call them out there. They don't know any better.
Oh, okay. You know what the neatest thing I ever saw with gophers mounds, gophers all over, was in North Dakota, north of the interstate, and they had the remains of the Mandan Indians, where all the earth lodges were along the Heart River, and it was real soft ground, you know, good silt ground where all those Mandan villages were, and it was probably 40 or 50 lodges that had, you know, sunk down in, and there's still the extra dirt there, but through the whole area there, you couldn't go maybe 2 feet without seeing a pocket gopher mound sticking up. And every one of those had oodles of shards of bone, probably no more than an eighth of an inch wide, maybe a half inch long. And I thought, why were all those shards of bones there that these pocket gophers were digging up? But I guess it's all the Indians, and that's how they got their mineral intake. You know, they'd have all the stuff they'd use as roast in those bags of hot water, and then they'd pound the heck out of those bones and then put those back in so you'd get more surface area, I guess, for making those little shards that then they absorb the nutrients into the liquid. But in Yellowstone, pocket gophers, the best I saw of that was they keep bringing up all the arrowheads. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
I was stationed in Fort Bliss, El Paso, and they have an area there called the Waco Tanks where the Mescalero Apache lived. And cave painting, just a beautiful area, but found a lot of artifacts out in that area. It's always fun when you find an arrowhead.
Yeah. I found
across the United States, the wildlife experts are calling this summer as one of the busiest years for bear encounters. Yes, and with winter coming on, it's going to get a little worse. So if you live in an area where there are lots of bears, be prepared.
Now, why would they say in the winter it's going to get worse?
Well, they're going to start stocking up for the winter, so they're going to be eating a lot more, as you know, because you have two big black bears yourself.
Well,
you know, I guess they're talking about their hibernation, of course. In Yellowstone, of course, it was they'd always hibernate on the north sides of the slopes of real steep hills so that the snow would stay over top of them all winter. And they'd dig up underneath of a big old pine tree on a real steep slope, and then that snow would cover them all winter. But here in Iowa, the grizzly bears in all of the tall grass prairie, they would they'd go into semi-hibernation, maybe a couple, 3 weeks, bad weather, but then they'd go out because they had a lot of game they could still hunt. But they just mound together, I guess, a bunch of prairie grass and sod, and then just put that over top of them, and then they'd sleep in there. So different than Yellowstone and areas where the north is, where the black bears are hibernate all winter.
That's true. And I know you realize, too, that it's a beautiful day in the middle of winter. The bears will come out.
Yeah, the bears would be out today.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in Yellowstone one time, and if it gets warm, then you have to worry when you'd ski towards spring, and that's when you did most of your skiing clear in the backcountry, where you'd go maybe a 100-mile ski trips to different cabins, shoveling the roads. And if it started getting warm, you had to worry about the bears coming out, the grizzly bears. And one of the cabins that I patrol out of, Cabin Creek Cabin, that one, and of course it was well before me, but the grizzly tried to get in the roof while the two rangers were in there. And the only thing they had was a pitchfork. The cabins used to have a few bales of hay that they keep there for late fall for horses. And they jabbed at that bear, and blood would come down poking, and finally got daylight, and the bear left. But anyway, that's grizzly bears, and that's hibernating and coming out of hibernation. So, yeah, they were hungry then.
Yeah. Well, a pitchfork will protect you from a lot of different animals.
Amen.
Amen. I know.
Let's do the local news, and then we'll do Guess Who's Gotten Older so we can get Bob on. We're running a little long, so. All right, local news, Indianapolis, Indiana. The Indianapolis Zoo will add a black mamba and other exotic snakes to a new exhibit set to open in 2019.
Good for them.
You've worked with a black mamba before, haven't you?
Yes, and it's scary. Fastest of all snakes, and they've got a venom. Well, in the parts of Africa, they carry machetes around. So if you're bitten by a mamba, they think that the only way to survive is to immediately cut off whatever got bit, a hand, an arm, a foot. They do it right there in the field. Wham! Over. Done.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know what to tell anybody. I don't want what's worse.
You know, in the movie Kill Bill, the guy got struck in the face by a black mamba. I guess they could have cut off his head and then saved him that way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
All right, I threw this story in for Bob. Did you hear about this, Bob? Boisman, Montana. Ear Spring, a thermal spring in Yellowstone National Park, has erupted for the fourth time in the last 60 years.
Was that fountain, that big geyser, that I can't think of it. Did it erupt real high, or is this another one?
This is Ear Spring.
Ear Spring. No, I'm not familiar with that. Go ahead.
Well, it just erupted. It's only erupted for four times in the last 60 years there in Yellowstone.
Okay, yeah, there. All those. I had some geysers down in my area that they never knew were there, and I'd see little teeny eruptions in the morning, and finally they went down there and they said, "Yeah, this is a couple of geysers we didn't know about." Yeah.
Well, they should have named them after you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Those should be the Jackson geysers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. It's time to play Who's Gotten Older.
I hate this game.
He does. He hates it. All right. Our first celebrity up on the list today is singer Jerry Lee Lewis. How old do you think Jerry Lee Lewis is?
81. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh, I'm supposed to guess?
Oh, yeah.
I liked him on playing that piano, of course, when you're young and got all the energy. So I'm 32 years old now, so he's probably about 38. No, I'm a few years older than that. So I guess he's probably around, I'm 71 maybe. I'll go on the bottom side, 80 years old. That way anything below that, I get to claim his victory over Larry here. So go ahead.
Well, Jerry Lee Lewis turned 83, so I think Larry won that one.
Oh,
you're
right.
Still
hate it.
Yeah, that'll be the only one he wins. So, all right, singer Chubby Checker.
Chubby Checker. Oh my God. Go ahead, Paul.
I think he's a little older than Jerry Lee. Chubby Checker's probably 84.
I'll say 88.
Oh. Well, you're both just a little bit off on this one. Chubby Checker turned 77.
Oh.
All right, local artist John Mellencamp.
Shit. I don't know him much at all. I'm not going to guess except he's up into all of our vintage area. So I'll say 72.
I will say 65.
Yeah, I think you're more right, Larry.
Yeah, well, John turned 67 today.
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah, he still has a little faster, too.
All right, let's do Olivia Newton-John. She had a birthday September 26th.
Oh, we love us some Olivia Newton-John. I'm telling you.
What is it, Saturday Night Fever? Is that what she was part of? John
Grease.
Travolta was.
Yeah,
huh?
Grease.
Yeah, Grease.
Grease.
I can't hear you.
Grease.
The movie Grease.
Yeah.
I'll say she's 75.
I'll say she's 70.
Oh, Mr. Batson got that one. She turned 70.
Oh, where he's, you know, I got my excuse. I was in the back country for 30 years, you know, 5 months a year. I lost out in a lot. That's the reason I'm losing out to Larry. And the only reason, yeah, that's it.
That's because
yeah.
you spent a lot of time in the woods.
Yeah.
I think I would have rather spent a lot of time in the woods than know these celebrities. I'll tell you that right.
Yeah, me too. All right, now, if Shelley Leibowitz is listening, I think he might get this one. Annie Leibowitz. Now, Bob, do you know who Annie Leibowitz is?
Is she a painter in New York or something like that? No, a photographer. Isn't she
a photographer? That's
photographer?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And Shelley Leibowitz is the underwriter for our show.
Hmm.
So I think he would know the answer to this one.
I'm not going to. She's going to be, we'll say, 78.
I'll say 78. Yeah, I have no idea.
Well, Mr. Batson, I think he won today. She turned 69 on Tuesday.
Yeah. I know more of the Big Lebowski. Lebowski, not Leibowitz. Yeah, Lebowski.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, now, before we do the fact of the day, we want to remind all of our listeners that this is the time of the year the big game are on the move, like moose, deer, elk, you know, they're all on the move. So be very careful because there are a lot of accidents caused when these animals this time of the year are out there roaming around. Here's an example. Portland, Maine, the state saw close to 300 car moose collisions in 2017.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what the worst ones in Yellowstone for the, except, well, a big buffalo bull hitting a car wasn't very good, but the moose ones, whenever they call in the moose accidents, what a moose does is cut such long legs that they usually go right into the windshield and then smash that. So we had more bad accidents where people hurt with moose, even though the numbers weren't there. But whenever we got the call that there was a moose accident, it's like we knew that windshield was all smashed because they had those long legs. So like a deer would hit in front, but a moose would go right over the top of the hood and hit right the windshield. So that was pretty hairy on a moose accident in Yellowstone.
That's why we like to warn our listeners.
Yeah.
All right. The fact of the day. The black bear is the smallest yet most common of the three bear species found in America, after the grizzly and the polar bear. Now, the current population estimate is around 750,000 individual bears. And that's the Wild World News for Sunday, October the 7th.
Well, once again, a great job done by Dr. Henry Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, now HD. And the beautiful knotty pine paneling sounds fantastic. Good job. Great acoustics. Want to remind everyone that today's program is always brought by SRI Records, home of the greatest music in jazz, rock, country. Dollar SRI Records. Go to their website. Have a list. You don't even have to buy it.
I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go. Anytime I move my finger, lucky me, can't you see? I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let go. I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life. I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a crazy so-and-so if I should ever let go. I have got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. What a world. Look at that beautiful girl. What a wonderful life. I'm in love.
A little Mel Torme from the SRI record label group here on Wild World, and we've got a fantastic show to plan for you today. Bob Jackson is a super ranger that patrolled the wilds of Yellowstone for over three decades in pursuit of poachers. What a masterful job he did. We're going to hear his amazing stories of living in the backcountry among bears, bighorn, and Bigfoot. On Wild World and all the way from his bison ranch in Iowa, it's our pleasure to introduce to this great audience, Bob Jackson. Good afternoon, Bob.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here.
Yeah, it's really good. It's been a while since I've been on.
I know.
What should we talk about today? I don't know. Caves. You want to talk about caves in Yellowstone?
We do want to talk about caves in Yellowstone.
I would love to talk about caves.
These are caves that probably 97% of them never had a white person in before. Indians, lions, bears. A lot of bighorn sheep in those caves. But caves were fascinating where I was. Yeah. It was one of the neatest things I ever saw was in a cave. Had to be with a spear that was there. But anyway, go ahead, Larry. We can talk about anything. We can talk about anything you want to.
No, we want to talk about caves because I find that absolutely incredible. And do you remember the first time you discovered these caves in Yellowstone?
You really don't as much, you know, like the first 3 years in Yellowstone, I worked as the Bureau of Sport Fisheries. And since this other guy and I were supposedly good fishermen, then they'd send us on camping trips where we'd have to get like 10 pounds of trout, that we put on formaldehyde, and then they'd ship them to Denver, cause they'd want to see what the pollution was. And so I'd start seeing some of this stuff. Usually when you're thinking of mountains, you're thinking of the mountaintops and the snow. But once you're on a horse, working as a ranger, then you get to look around more. And then you start seeing caves. And then, of course, it's almost mesmerizing. Because every time you're going up the valley, any valley, you're looking on the sides of those mountains for the caves. And so most of the time you'd be tying your horse down below and then maybe hoofing it up a quarter mile up the sides of those slopes. And originally the first 10 years or so, you're just thinking, ooh, cave, ooh, what do we see in here? What do we have? And you always had a flashlight with you. But then you start thinking of who else would have been in this cave? Who else would have thought? And so whenever you'd start finding Indian camps, you know, maybe ones that had maybe 30, 40 wickiups or teepees in them, because they all were 14-foot diameter, and the rocks are all still there. And then you think, where are the little kids going? And then you look up to the caves that are up there, and you go, I'll bet you those kids went up into that cave. And, yeah, you'd see where the kids were thousands of years before, where they put the things on the ledges when they're up in those caves. Yeah. So you started thinking more than just exploring caves, you put the element of the animal, you know, the south face and hillside caves, those were the mountain lions would stay in. And whenever you approached one of those from below, you always made a noise because you didn't want to be in the mouth of a cave if the mountain lion was there. So you'd see these tracks when you get there where they've been zooming out of there, you know, running fast, you know, but you couldn't see it from below. So those are the mountain lion caves. Then you had the human caves, and you had the prehistoric caves. Those were really neat because prehistoric caves, what I call them, are from, you know, the era of, like, sequoia trees and everything millions of years ago. And those were the agatized petrified wood that would be sticking out all around in those caves, just almost like porcupine quills. And you'd go in those caves and you turn your flashlight on and there'd be like stalactites, stalagmites, and the Indians would go in there and they would chip off some of that agatized petrified wood and they'd put their cores and things up on ledges. And it'd still be there thousands of years ago from before. So anyway, I'm kind of monologuing, but that's some of the stuff that you just can't get enough of. And it's still there, and I left it all there. I don't want lots of people going into those, but they're not going to go up into them anyway. I don't think most of them, just because they're so remote. And it's going to be hard for people. Once you're on a trail, all the ones divert off and spend 3 hours going up off of that trail to get to those caves. But, what more do you want to know about humans? And I can tell you about a spear that I found.
Well, what kind of a feeling did you have to walk into these caves and think about the people and the animals that call this part of their home, part of their heritage? I mean, it had to give you just chills to see some of the things that you saw in these caves in Yellowstone.
When you don't know much, you know, let's say the first 30, 40 caves you go into, it's like the unknown. You don't know. And these are all dry caves, by the way. This isn't something that's got water in it. These are up on the sides of mountains. And they'd be at a certain level, you know, where there's a certain band of that type of rock, and it'd cave away or make the caves. Some of those, though, once you got into it, you'd see a cave, and then you're trying to look for water. If there's water anywhere near that cave, even though it was maybe 1,000 yards
mm-hmm.
or 1,000 feet up off of the valley floor, you think, are people going to stay in those things? And if they had water within a couple hundred yards coming out of the hills, you know, the rocks, then you looked a lot closer. And then you would start seeing the smoke up on the tops of the caves. And, you know, you wonder what those people were doing there. You know, if they're the sheep eater types that were hunting the sheep on those mountainsides or not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you find water and then you find caves with flat bottoms. And some of those caves would be maybe a roof 40, 50 foot high, and it goes back in 150 feet. These aren't caves like Kentucky that are like made out of limestone that they go for miles. These are, you know, going back in and then maybe some chambers off to the side of it, you know, that's really dark. But if you saw a cave and it was mounded up dirt in front, you know, where you had a 60-foot entry, and then you had dirt mounded up in front of it, maybe 6-7 feet high or 5 feet, then you knew those people were trying to keep from people below seeing them. So that's what some of those caves were like. And it was really, really, each one was different, each cave. And some of them were bust. You know, where you thought, oh, I bet this is really, because the darker it was looking up into them, the more they went further back. But I don't know. I mean, they were, it was neat seeing each one. The best one, or if you want to call it that, most exciting, because I'd always look for the old mountain men type of cabins that were in the park too. And, you know, you'd find in the wintertime those old toboggans and stuff in those subalpine fir thickets, you know, that were, they'd been stashed in there. And they'd left them maybe 7,500 years ago. But the caves, northwest section of the park, those are the ones that mostly had a lot of the petrified forest trees in them. And some of those you could dig away a little bit of the surface area, and it was just like wood. I never did see if you could burn it, but it'd be charred front, and then it looked just like wood. I should have seen if I could burn it, but I never did. But the neatest was in some of those caves that were probably about, oh, maybe 20, 30 of them that went for a half a mile on a ledge that was, I didn't even know if I could get out in there. I tied the horse below, and at the far end of that line, you'd see where the bighorn sheep, because this almost vertical face, and then at the end of that, they would scrape at this loose, soft rock and lick it, and you could look through your binoculars and see them. And, of course, sheep need a lot of mineral, and that's what they would be doing. So the sheep, I knew, would go along that ledge. You could see them when I'm riding all the different times. And I thought, I wonder if I could make it along that ledge. And, you know, I was tied my horse below and then went up through the trees and then started on that ledge going, because I wanted to see what those, what kind of rocks, if I could taste the mineral myself that they were licking on. But I probably got about halfway there, and there's probably four or five small caves on that ledge. And then it got really, really narrow, and I thought, man, I don't know, because it's probably about 100 foot straight down. And then, of course, above you, that ledge, it was probably 400 or 500 feet straight up above me. But I saw an elk track, and I thought, okay, I know I can't go where sheep go sometimes, but I can go where an elk goes. And so I kept on going, and it narrowed down to probably the width of, you know, where you're shuffling along, and then you're putting your arms out against the side of the rock, the cliff face, you know, because, but curiosity keeps you going, you know, and there's no one out there. If you fell, of course, I'd be dead anyway. But then I saw this in this real narrow area that was probably 40, 50 yards wide, a cave that really had been all built up of stones, with grass growing in those stones. And it was probably about a cave, probably 4 foot high entrance. And the stone was probably 10, 12 feet on each side of a little hole, a hole that was probably no more than a foot in diameter. And you'd look into that hole, and it was pure black. And so it's like, yeah, humans built, put all these stones in front in this narrowest area of this ledge. You know, and after this narrow area, it got into big caves out there with entrances, you know, 100 and some feet high and going back in, you know, and so there's big, big caves. But this was an area, so I kept shuffling along, and I got around into a little bit wider area, maybe 20 foot wide, and then I saw an entrance to that cave, that same one, to the side. And so I got my flashlight out, of course, because I always carry that looking when you're looking in caves. And I crawled in there, and it wasn't any more than probably 5 foot high at the most. So I crawled back that 15, 20 feet to where that little hole was. And before I got to the hole, here was a spear, probably 7 feet long. And it wasn't, didn't have a point on it. It was just a pointed at the end. It was sharpened. It was wood. And so it was sharpened at the end, and it was laying right near where that hole was. And tell me what you think that spear was for in that cave that had been blocked off in the front that was probably an area 12 to 18 inches wide, and then it dropped straight off below. So tell me why the Indians were there with that spear.
Well, Go ahead, Dr. Day.
Well,
go ahead.
I would say for poking people in the face when they were trying to come in the cave.
Yeah, I could have. Think about hunting. You got sheep at the very end, and maybe 20, 30 a day that would go onto that slope, you know, that to get their mineral. That's the only way they could get to it. So I'm giving you a little hint here. So.
Well, they use them to hunt bighorn.
Huh?
They use those to hunt bighorns.
They poked them off the ledge. They poked them. They just poked it straight ahead, and then they'd jump. They poke them off the ledge. I'm sure that's what it was. And then they gather up the animal below. Yeah. So that was really neat finding that. I'd left it there. And then they had an archaeologist in West Yellowstone that came up from Utah State every year in the museum. And so I took him out there to show him it. And he took pictures of it, and we left it there. And it's hopefully still there, that spear is. So that was one of the neatest ones to look in a cave, to see that. There's supposed to be caves up in that area that you could access better with a horse. And that's where the Army, the Cavalry and that, on their patrols, they would stay overnight in those caves, you know, with their horses and everything, and stay dry. But I never did know what that cave was. Most of the ones that I went to of that size that would have been needed for something like that, they were pretty much inaccessible. Unless maybe 100 years ago they had maybe some landslides that made those caves now inaccessible. I don't know. But
I've been to Yellowstone a couple of times, and I never knew any of that. I'd never heard about it, so that's very intriguing. And
you guys are hearing it, except for my friends, this is probably the first I've ever. Maybe because I'm 70 years old, you know, you need to relay that stuff. But at the same time, you know, I used to think I don't want people to know, because then they're going to start looking in those caves. And you know, I recorded them all in the log books, you know, for posterity. But, you know, it's kind of like waterfalls in Yellowstone. They got a book on waterfalls, you know. To me, it's like you get huge amounts of people there because you advertise it and sell about it. Then it takes some of the mystery and some of the discovery out of it. But, caves anyway. Most of them are too dangerous to get into.
Well, yeah, no reason to publicize them, because they just put more hardship on the National Park Service to pull all these crazy people to venture into these caves. So that mountain climbing is bad enough. Now spelunking in Yellowstone. Our guest, Bob Jackson. We're going to take a short break. Gosh, what an amazing show, Dr. Jay.
Yeah, we were excited.
We were, with good reason. We'll be back in just a couple moments. Here's a little Ray Brown from the SRI Label Group here on Wild World on this magical network, gentlemen, Blog Talk Radio.
She knocked me off my feet. Hey! SRI Jazz is proud to present their newest release, This is Ray Brown Jr. That's right, Ella Fitzgerald's son continues to entertain audiences with his warm and charming vocals, making this one of the best vocal jazz albums of the year. Here are some sample tracks from the album. Visit our website to hear all of them in their entirety. Just go to srirecords.com or click on the banner in your media player now.
It's wonderful, marvelous, you should care for me. Awful nights, paradise, what I love to see. My baby, when she walks by, all the bells go, I know why. Simply 'cause that girl's so fine. If she'd ever leave me, I'd lose my mind. She's got the kind of loving, kissing and a hugging, sure he's mellow. Glad that I'm a fella, and I know, 'cause she knocked me off my feet. Have mercy on me. I know for certain, one I love. I'm through with flirting. It's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, you must take the A-train to go to Sugar Hill, way up in Harlem.
You've been listening to a few sample tracks from the new album, This is Ray Brown Jr. You can hear all the songs in their entirety at srirecords.com. Support jazz music today at srirecords.com. Consideration provided by SRI Jazz.
Hi, everyone. This is Shelley Newports. You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Wild Talk Radio.
That's right. This is Larry Batson, broadcasting from Clinton Falls, Indiana. We are so excited. We have a good friend. And I'll tell you what, Dr. Day, Bob Jackson, had the coolest year of just about anybody else.
Without a doubt. Except for the really dangerous part.
Well, we can talk next time about bear caves. Bear caves are the scariest. Those are the grisly ones. And when I was young, I used to read all those books about cave bears and everything. And this is real life stuff where you find bones, carcasses in there, and the fronts of them have got, you know, where they've drug bison into them or anything else. Yeah, and those are still skeletons there, and where you find where the bears died in the wintertime in some of those. So those are, you know, like one behind a waterfall.
cave where you go in there, and there's all these beds where the bears slept during the winter, you know. So in the wintertime, if it's summertime, you think, okay, no bear here. But when you see where they've been dragging things into their animals in the front, then they could be there anytime. That's summertime activity. So anyway, we could have a whole new time on grizzly bear or cave bears. Yeah, cave bears are interesting, definitely.
What was your thoughts when you climbed into one of these caves and all of a sudden it dawned on you that this is a grizzly bear cave?
Usually I could tell what was going to be a bear cave before I ever got there. Like if it was bones down underneath, lower, then you knew that the bears were bringing something in. And wherever there was that kind of cave, that was down lower to the bottom of the valleys. You know, where this is accessible, it isn't one clear up on the ledges in that area. And if it was a clear up high, you know, 10,000 feet, and like, you know, you'd alpine tundra areas where you have waterfalls coming down, small ones, you know, from the snow melt, and then you go in underneath of those caves, those waterfall ones, and you figured those are pretty much for a bear hibernating, and those were different than the ones that were down low. If it was down low, yeah, then those are hairy. I threw rocks in there, stuff like this, to make sure there wasn't a one, you know, but at the same time, you know, you never knew for sure, you know, what was in there. You know, you could have been sleeping good after eating well. So it was kind of hairy going into the caves that were down low next to the grasslands. Those were the bear caves that were probably the scariest that I ever went into. And there's probably only three or four of those through all the years that I had where that was that type of a cave. Yeah.
But it was, I mean, it was this scary kind of like riding a roller coaster scary. Or was it like, hey, I might die walking into the cave?
Every day you could die. I mean, most all the rangers stayed on the trail all the time because in a lot of that area you didn't have radio reception. If you got hurt, throwing off a horse or whatever, or something happened with the bear or whatever, there's no one that's going to save you. So you just got to make the decision, you know, is it worth it? You know, for me it was worth it to take the odds, the chances, and you do everything you can, and you make it for 30 years. But anytime you're off trail in all that country, then that's bear country. That's their turf. Bears know on the maintained trails in Yellowstone that they're going to encounter humans. But if it's off of there and you surprise one of them, and it's at their turf, they're dead. I mean, you don't really call them caves, but all those scrubby pine that were 3-4 feet high, maybe 5 feet, and they're real, bunch of them together, and they're near, like, little ponds up there real high. And you look in those, you know, because there's all the elk hooves, you know, the little calves that they were eating, and they scat would be with those little hooves in their scat. And, man, those things were almost as much as an earth cave. Those were a big boar with all these, that was his turf. And so whenever you start seeing a bunch of scat around an area, you knew you were getting pretty close to one of those, I don't know, day dens or whatever that those bears had. And no one knows about those things. They don't think of bears as having those kind of homes, but that's what they'd have in those areas that you didn't know about. I mean, that people don't travel, you know, those kind of. And they actually, they weren't as dark, but they definitely looked back in there, you know, maybe 8-9 feet. And that was his home. So we could have another scary, but every day was that way. Yeah.
Well, you know, Bob, one of the most intriguing things, I talked to a gentleman that works with bears like we do, and they said that they thought bears were as intelligent as the great apes, except they did not have the facial expression.
I could only hear part of that, Larry. You're saying that the intelligence, is that of a bear you're talking?
Yeah, that the bear's intelligence was as great as the great apes, except they did not have the facial expressions gorillas and chimpanzees have.
Oh, I believe it. I mean, any animal that's going to circle you, like when whether it was the Indians that were after them, you know, when they had troubles in a camp, and then maybe six braves would go after a grizzly bear, and this is on the plains.
Yeah.
They'd always lose one or two, and that wasn't when you're tracking a grizz like that, then they'll circle, and all the hunters know that. And if they come behind you like that, then that's a pretty smart animal. It can tell when somebody's tracking them, and then they circle around behind them. We had two big maulings in Yellowstone in my country where it was like researchers, and, you know, they're tracking and tracking and coming back around, and, of course, that bear came in. The guy was taking a dump by a tree, and boom, this grizz got him, you know. And the guy's still alive. Part of his face is gone, you know. But that was a horror story. So, yeah, the bears and, yeah. I mean, it's all the stuff as a kid you think about. You know, you're reading all these outdoor life and all these first-person accounts and, you know,
sure.
You're thinking caves, bears, you know, mountains. Well, it really is that way. I mean, it's just that this was throwback from 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years. I mean, you could tell where the Indians went hunting because all the game trails are exactly the same. You know, you could see where a cliff, where a game trail went right underneath of it, and you think, okay, those Indians were up there 15, 20 feet right above that, and, of course, it's a slope right below it, pretty steep. All you have to do is go see where the Indians were waiting for the animals on that game trail to go by, and then you look below it, and there's all the broken spear points and all the broken arrowheads, you know, where they missed or whatever happened. All the Indian blinds, yeah, they'd in the rock. They're still there from 6,000 years ago. So, yeah. So caves are just a part of it. Caves are a part, but they're something that it maintained, like I say, all those obsidian cores or petrified wood cores that are beautiful, and they're just still on the ledges, you know, where people put them, you know, in thousands of years ago. So I think, and I will say my part of my contribution was I always took some pennies or nickels with me in the backcountry, you know, because you're back there for months. And when I'd go in those caves and I'd find a little ledge somewhere I didn't think, you know, pack rats or anything would disturb it, and I'd put one of those coins up there. And so maybe 1,000 years from now, somebody will find a coin in there. I don't know. But that was my contribution to the history of it. Yeah.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
That's
you know,
very interesting,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. We were talking about the intelligence of bears. It's dealing with an animal that's not quite so smart. And I'm speaking about poachers. You told me an interesting story. Bob Jackson was, let's put it this way, one of the great rangers of Yellowstone and any national park. Because my understanding is that you arrested more poachers at the time that you were there than all the rangers combined.
Yeah, they say I've caught more poachers than all the rangers combined for 70 years. Not that others didn't see them, but maybe they didn't know as much to actually get the convictions, you know, where everybody has a story. These aren't poachers that are drunked up and they're going along a road and they're shooting some deer or whatever, opportunistic. These are guides and outfitters and professional hunters. You know, one guy I got, he just hunted the blue ram, I guess is what it is in Russia. I don't even know for sure, but he was he hated giving up his Seiko rifle because that's what he'd use hunting all around the world. So all these guys have got stories, and they got two or three levels of stories, and so you just break it down over a couple 3 hours with them, you know, in the boonies like that, you know. So it's just you and them, and in the end, it's, I guess I had the advantage because I was the law enforcement federal guy, but it's a matter of how much energy you have and intensity under that situation, and that's why they'd always break down. Yeah, and you get great confessions. Yeah.
Well, I love the story that your little pad that you carried around your pocket to make notes on whatever, you would actually have. Tell us that. Now, this is
Okay. Yeah, there's a three-part story that our local newspaper just did. three different weeks, and some of these things that I'd never really discussed before, and you get to the age, and I guess it's sort of like in the war, military, and then old guys start telling finally what happened. And so, you know, it wasn't something that you relished, but it always happened. I only had one guy, an outfitter that was a pathological liar. I caught him shooting an elk in Yellowstone, and then I caught him for poaching a mountain lion in Yellowstone. That's where you had to track him back to camp, and he's the only one that didn't cry. You know, that's not that many, really. I mean, you got 25 cases in 30 years. That's less than one a year. And but, you know, those are regular big cases. I don't look at the little ones as really a case at all. But they would, once you break it down, they're there. Maybe if they're professional types, there's one. If they're guides together where they're trying to get an elk out, a big one for a client that maybe wants to pay $10,000 so he could take a big one back to, let's say, Florida.
Yeah.
To let people know you got a big elk. So the guide's coming in, a couple guides. And then you had your poacher rings that actually went way interior. You had those that were camping, maybe three guys in the park, maybe 4 or 5 miles. And they're having just little teeny fires. And usually it'd take 6-7 years to catch them because you had so much country to patrol. And then you'd try to see trails and camps and horse tracks. But once you got them, then, you know, it's really, you don't try to come in with just guns blazing type. You just pretend like, hi, are you? How are you doing? You know? And because they don't think, really, no, that's how you do it. Because, I mean, one time I had another ranger with me, and because you always have a 12-gauge pump in every cabin, and you got a M14 in there, and, you know, so you got some firepower in case you need it. But if you had another ranger along that happened to be where you had to really, you know, you knew you had a camp, and then you had time to set it up, and then you'd have them take 12-gauge, and as long as he didn't say anything, they didn't know he didn't know anything. So you put him by a tree. Your shotgun always had alternating slugs and double-aught buck. And that was for bears and people. And you put him maybe 30, 40 yards away from the, you know, where the guys, you try to wait till daylight where they're just getting their fire going and they're kind of slow moving. And then you just, you come in, hi guys, how you doing? And that guy, you put him by a tree with that shotgun, and you tell him no matter how long it takes, you just stay there. If they say something to you, like come on in or whatever, I said, don't say a word, nothing at all, because if nothing comes out of his mouth, then they don't know if he's a greenhorn or a seasoned ranger. So it was very effective in cases like that. But if you're up there in the high mountains and the guy I got the Seiko from, he shot an elk up high country, real high, well way, miles off of any trail. And he'd had his son, who was 30-some years old, guide him, you know, with waving from up on top high outside the park as to where the elk were down below. And so he shot one down in there. And he'd been all over the world, but in that case, just like other ones, but each one's unique, it took probably 3-4 hours to get it where he took every story, and then you saw the tracks going down in the park, and then finally they don't have a story, and they break, and they'll put a leg up on a rock or something, and their head goes down, and the tears start coming down, and they do. And then you go down to them. You're not trying to be confrontational, but at the same time, you're just dealing with this guy all the time. If it's a single or if it's a couple, three, it's a little different. Actually, it's easier if you have two or three than one guy. One guy, you're on a poacher like that, and it's a tougher case. Then you just have this Forest Service notebook in your front pocket, and you always have a ballpoint. One time I had to do it because the ballpoint didn't work, and the confession was done on the lid of my .44 pistol. That's how he had to write it out. And that's, but, you know, as soon as the tears come, then you get that out and you say, just write it down. And it probably happened 3-4 times where it actually did. I mean, it isn't something you brag about, but it's stress for what they're doing. And so if they get too many tears on the paper they're writing, then I just rip that page off and I'd say, please start over. And in this case, with this guy, and then you leave them always, if they have horses, you leave them with a pistol or something that in case they break a leg on a horse. So then you meet them the next day, and of course, the sun's there and they got a big fire going, and it's an outfitter camp where they've been coming out of. And so the camp is, or that fire is maybe 30, 40 yards beyond all the tents. And it's snowing, it's blowing, and you go there, because the night before, you're going down 6-7 miles along this stream. You can't even get back to your stakeout camp, because there's cliffs all around, and once it's dark, you can fall off those cliffs. And so you can't even get back to stakeout camps. And so then you're going down through a stream with rushing water, and you hope a bear, because a bear is never going to hear you. But then you got to go 12 miles the next day to get to where these two guys are going to be, and you tell them you meet them there, and then they're around that fire. And the one guy's on the one side on a log, you know, where the hunters would always stay around a big fire, and the sun is on the other side. And you get the, you know, I let them take the Seiko rifle back because I didn't want to take it down that real steep mountain creek drainage. And so, which is a mountain creek drainage, I mean, escarpment creek drainage. There's no trail. Down timber, everything. You get back at 3, 4 in the morning. But then, you know, I asked him for his Seiko because I told him to bring it. You know, I was going to get it. And he had it. And I got it. And the tears started coming a little bit, you know, because that's the one he had for all those decades of hunting all around the world. And then I said, well, by then, the son on the other side is crying, you know, more than the father is. And then you ask him for these ammo, you know, his box of shells. And so here you got the Seiko shells. And then all at once, the two of them just get together 15, 20 feet apart. And they just right by the fire, and it's blowing snow and wind. And they're just embracing each other, and they're both just crying and crying. That one, probably that son never went hunting again. The father, I don't know, it probably stopped him. But if you got guides and hunters and outfitters, they hate you 2 weeks later because their status of poaching in Yellowstone is gone, you know, with all their buddies and friends. But, you know, at that time, they're making great confessions when it's on site. So that's how you get them, and that's how it is. That's what it was like. And if you got to hear shots further up in the drainage, you may tie your horse a quarter of a mile away, and then you wait by the game trail that you know they're coming down, and you're waiting for hours in the dark, you know. And mine, you can't have your horse with you. My horse would never whinny. But if their horse is whinny, then, you know, you're always at a place where you can come out. Those are ones that, those are the cases that, you know, it's bad guys, good guys. You know, you're not trying to pretend like, oh, how you doing? You know, none of that. It's just, you got to get them in a place where they can't turn around with their horses, and you got them, you got the jump on them. You got the drop on them, so to speak. But if their horse whinnies, and that, I learned that early on in my career, then those guys are zooming. They got time to get out of there. So you miss them in the middle of the night. And you're not going to go after them in the middle of the night anyway. So that's how you do it. And if it's after dark and they're coming into an eagle camp, you wait till they get the fire started. And then you come in when they're at the fire because they can't see in the darkness. And so you come out of the darkness. And that effectively helps. Yeah, I should write a book on how to catch poachers.
I'm at the movie right now. I'm hearing these stories. This is
I agree.
But that's God bless Bob Jacks. Thank goodness there's somebody in the wilds of Yellowstone, these national parks that are after these low lives that get involved doing this illegal hunting. I just can't stand it. My goodness.
Well, actually, the last decade I was there, everybody tried to keep me from catching poachers. Because, like, if you're an outfitter and you got a camp, U.S. Forest Service, right outside the park, and, you know, they're maybe bringing in $400,000 worth of income in 7 weeks with all the hunters coming in, paying $5,000 or $6,000 a pop. The Forest Service is supposed to, when I catch them, then the Park Service, Forest Service, Game and Fish, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, all those were memorandum of understanding. And so the first time you have a major case, like I catch an outfitter, then that guy's put on probation. The second time, he's supposed to have his permit yanked. And as an outfitter, whether it's Wyoming or Montana or Idaho or the Forest Service was the main one that they got their permit to have the camp on, U.S., you know, felt wilderness areas. But none of them wanted to take it. You catch them the second time, like that outfitter I caught the lion on? They do everything to keep from doing that. And so if I go back to Iowa for the winter, then all at once that case would be like one outfitter. He shot an elk 3.5 miles in. He's a good case. And, you know, right there, hot. And when I came back next spring, they changed it to destruction of natural features so that they didn't have to try to take these. And, you know, those are cases where, and they, because you see when they poach an animal, then they're just taking the skull plate and the horns, you know, and they're leaving everything else when it's that far in. And so they just got a single-bitted axe, and they chop that thing off, and they're out of there quick. But they don't want the ravens and eagles to find it because then they circle around, and then that's what I use, the same as coyotes, to find the places where they poached an animal. So they chop down little trees, little pine trees, and they put over top that whole body so that there's more time, and, you know, like maybe it gives them an extra 3 days before the ravens will come onto it. So that's what they cited this guy in the end for, not shooting the elk. I mean, my case was right there. All the citation was there. The guy cried, everything. But in the end, they got him for chopping down some little trees in Yellowstone instead of that case. So it made it a lot worse. They wouldn't give me the information, like where spike camps were, for sheep hunters, you know, that they're supposed to get a permit. Those that came through in the park in the summertime were supposed to get permits. I couldn't get the entrance stations. The employees would, but they'd never let it because I could radio in at night and get that information. So it got to be a problem just for me catching poachers, which you would think that'd be by far, but the complications, the political life that was accompanied that, you know, like when the outfitter is real good friends with the vice president of the United States. They don't want to have that stuff going on. So you could still do it, but, and they couldn't really get rid of me because I already had the status of catching all these poachers, but they definitely tried to keep it so it really wouldn't happen. And the guys that were in the interior of the park, we called them the Delta Boys. Those were hunting on elk that were a herd of 300 that stayed in Yellowstone year-round. So you had royals, you know, 7x8 racks, huge racks, and they were putting people in there hunting, and then they would take them out in a big white boat, you know, in the middle of the night on Yellowstone Lake. And that's really a poaching ring. Anyway, long story. We could talk for a half hour just on that case there, but I never did catch any of the Delta Boys, and they're probably still, either they or their sons are still poaching there in the southeast arm of Yellowstone Lake on that herd. Yeah, so.
Well, Dr. Day, what are you doing next week? Maybe we should head out there.
That sounds like a great idea.
Well, take care of that little problem. My gosh.
We'll help out if we can.
Hey, I have to
Go ahead. I couldn't hear about half of that sentence, so go ahead again, though.
Well, I have to ask you, because we were at the Bigfoot conference last week, so once again, if you don't mind, tell everyone your encounters with this supposedly legendary creature in Yellowstone National Park.
They just put it in the Cowboys and Indians magazine. It came out this month on probably the main one on that. How much time? We got 5 minutes? Or
we got 10 minutes.
What?
We got 10 minutes.
Okay. Well, I don't want to monopolize all that. Plus, any questions you have while I'm talking, then feel free to interrupt. The Bigfoot in Yellowstone, you know, he's there. He was there. He was there a lot more before the fires of 88. And I logged it in the logbook. I see something on the internet, you know, where Ranger Bob Jackson or Action Jackson sees a Bigfoot, and they'll have a guy narrating it. And, you know, he says, well, you know, I wouldn't tell anybody about it till after retired, and some of the information they got wrong. So you're always going to have that happen when you have something like this. But you try to, you know, in this case, it was a couple weeks before I actually saw it. You know, there's an outfitter. This is the northwest section of the park, and there's a trail or an area that was off the trail, Fan Creek, but there's an outfitter. He'd take his fishermen up there. This is summertime. And they would fish for those little cutthroats, but at that time there still were some of the mountain grayling. They're extinct, I guess, now, and the only place left was at Fan Creek. And when I worked Bureau of Sport Fisheries, we did a little bit of netting on that stream. That's different than the grayling that you have, you know, in like Grebe Lake, around Canyon, stuff like that. So anyway, that was the last of the grayling, I guess, of the mountain. I don't know what their name is, but they're mountain grayling. And but we're just chatting, the outfitter, the guide, and I, and all at once up in Upper Stellaria Creek, which is about 2 miles away from where we were, all at once this noise started, just, you know, kind of like I say, like a thousand elk going to their death or Tarzan. But the volume was so loud with no break in it, and we just like, what the heck is that? And so a couple weeks after that, I was coming out of our Sportsman Lake cabin, and my horses, I had, I think, 2 pack horses, and I had a riding horse. And whenever you have a grizzly bear, not so much a black bear, they won't ever flare their noses at, for somehow they know the difference. But my riding horse, he just wham, 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 blowing and snorting. And like, okay, grizz, 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 where in the hell is a grizz? And I was on a side slope, probably 40 yards, 50 yards off of this big subalpine fir meadow, maybe 60 acres or so, maybe 80, maybe 40. Anyway, it was up high, 9,000 feet, subalpine fir thickets. And if you know anything about subalpine, Dr. Day or Larry, do you know anything about subalpine fir thickets, what they look like?
Kind of, not really.
Okay, they're pointed in the middle. The biggest tree is in the very middle, and everything goes down kind of like a funnel to the ground. You may have 75 or 100 trees, and this is in a maybe 30-yard area.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it's so dense in these thickets that you could be skiing in the winter, 10 feet of snow, and you ski into those thickets, and there's not a bit of snow on the ground. It's so dense that the snow doesn't go in. And, in fact, when I'd look for the old mountain men stuff, you know, the old toboggans and that kind of stuff, then you go into those subalpine fir thickets on where you think these trails might be, where these mountain men would go through, and that's where you'd find they'd stash the stuff in there, you know. And it stays in there 100 years. There's old trees in there and stuff that had died, and they're hundreds of years old. It just preserves everything. But anyway, I looked down below, and right below me was a subalpine fir thicket with a little bit of probably 30, 40 feet of grass and kind of a mild, you know, sloping, gentle meadow. And saw a deer, a little deer, right on the edge of that thicket below me. And I thought, what the heck is that deer there if there's a bear here? You know, in other words, you're not going to have a deer anywhere near a grizzly bear. And it was just grazing right on the edge. And I held the horses, and it was a steeper hillside. It was open trees. It wasn't rock or anything. But you don't ever want to hold them too long, because if you got animals and they get off the trail, then they can wrap you around on the rope, you know, where you get a tree in between and they're sliding down the slope a little bit, and it's dangerous for you and the horses. So you got to keep moving. But I held it for probably 25 seconds, I don't know, half minute at the very most, with the reins, and all at once that deer went boom out the away from that thicket, you know, zoom. And I thought, whoa. And within a half second out the other end comes this thing running. And black hair, long black hair. And I go, yeah, there's a bear. And then I thought, no, it's running on two legs. So it's like, and the arms weren't like a human. They weren't bent at the elbow. You know, they're longer ones. But it wasn't any 9 foot tall thing. It was probably, I don't know, between 6 and 7 feet high, maybe a little taller. It was down below, but it was within, you know, maybe 40 yards of me. But this thing ran. He never did face me, but I'm sure I flushed him out. Just like if you're, you know, you got dogs and you spot them on point on like a pheasant, and then they stay there and finally that pheasant flushes. Well, that's what this Bigfoot, and I'm sure he was in there, you know, he's going to grab that deer. But, you know, eat it is what he's going to do. But anyway, he went at an angle away from me to another subalpine fir thicket. He didn't run straight away like any bear or anything. They just go beeline away from you. Any animal does, mountain lion, anything. But this thing was zigzagged through all those subalpine fir thickets until it got the other end of the meadow. It was picking up cover wherever it could. Then it went into the big forest, you know, the river forest over there. So I didn't go down and look for tracks. I didn't think I needed to. It was in a grass meadow.
Yeah.
I knew what I saw. So that's what. And then a number of years later, I heard the same sound coming into a cabin at dark, and I had a watch on. As soon as I heard that thing, boy, I flicked that light on that watch, and 26 seconds long, that thing goes.
Wow.
And so, yeah, with volume, that you could have heard it, you know, 2-3 miles down Mountain Creek, or Howell Creek cabin going into Mountain Creek. That's where that was, up in the high country. So they, whatever it is, has got a huge amount of lug capacity, you know, that they can keep that sound. And there isn't any other animal, whether it's a grizzly bear or anything, or a lion, that would ever make that kind of noise. But one time we're skiing in the winter on one of those, I don't know, 80-mile trips, hard snow, because it's towards March. That's when you do most of your big skiing, so you don't have such soft snow. And we were going over Heart Lake Pass, Paycheck Pass, going into Heart Lake Cabin. And it was really easy skiing. You know, you got 50-pound packs on. You're going in the cabins to shovel the roofs, you know, so they don't break down, the eaves don't, when the snow starts melting. And that track was, you know, when you put your skis out, stretch out as far as you can from one to the next, that's about what the stride was. And that was a big, you know, big footprint. I'd say it's probably bigger than the one I saw. So that was, you know, the closest, that's the only other track, or the track that I saw during all those years. But after the 88 fires, there weren't near as many reports. They stayed in the real deep fir thickets, the cedar, not cedar, but not subalpine fir. I'm trying to think what the other fir is. But any of the dense timber, that's where they'd stay in, up in the northwest section of the park, north of Crescent Lake. They would stay in this. There were trees there that were probably 6 foot diameter. There's nothing like it in Yellowstone, but all those trees burnt during the fires, and so no one really heard or saw anything for a lot of years. In the 90s, late 90s, mid 90s, then you started having reports of them. You know, real good accounts on Beulah Lake on the other side of it. You know, so because people tell me about what reports they get, and then I'd ask them what the report is that they take. So it's just that, you know, in Yellowstone, you know, none of the rangers or anybody wanted to think like, well, yeah, we're making up a story. They didn't So then they never report it, but it's,
yes.
I guess we're like UFOs, you know, or something like that. You know, they just don't want to say it. I don't mind it. Hell, I can say what I saw. I don't care what anybody really thinks. But,
well,
hey, I have more stories with those. Yeah, well, guys were cherry bombs blasting behind them, you know, because the big crews would use them to keep bears away in the camp. Things like that. But anyway, that's my account. If that's what you wanted, you wanted that, Larry, and
yeah, that was absolutely perfect. In fact, I have to tell you, Bob, I've been looking at that for a number of years after your accounts and after your, because I consider you the best witness of a Bigfoot encounter because of your credibility. I mean, your testimony is tens of thousands of dollars, maybe, I don't know, prison time, lost property. So if you say you saw Bigfoot, I would say that's 110% credible.
Well, I will say, you know, people say, well, why haven't they found carcasses? And that's true. Why haven't they? I don't know that they haven't found the skeleton yet. I do know that in 30 years, and half of that travel was off trail, I've only found two bear carcasses. One was a poached black bear up near Eagle Creek Pass and Hall Creek on a poacher trail. And the other one was in one of those caves that I tell you about that was up high behind the waterfall. And we took that skull out, and it was a two-year-old grizzly bear. Those are the only two skeletons I've saw in 30 years and probably 70 to 80,000 miles on a horse and walking and all that stuff. So, you know, Yellowstone's probably got, you know, 300-400 grizzlies and the same amount of black bears. And that's all I saw in 30 years, two carcasses or two skeletons. So it isn't that easy to find a skeleton, I guess is what I'm saying. And
that's exactly right. Hey, Bob, gosh, thanks so much. Yes, Dr. Day.
Well, that's why we were excited all week, because we knew Bob was coming on, and it was a great show. Thank you, Bob.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to share it.
Well, we're going to do this again real soon, because he's our favorite. God bless you, Bob Jackson. And
we have to do it. That's right.
Yeah, we have to. He's got too much knowledge to share with the world, and we want to help make that possible. Thank you, Bob.
Yes,
we love you, man.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, goodbye, and keep up the good show, okay?
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Raw Talk Radio.